Welcome, everyone, to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in Northwest Lower Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. During the next hour, I will chat with Barbara Disborow about her new book, The Guide to Chocolate in the Grand Traverse Region. I will also be chatting with guitarist and composer John Wunsch about his approach to composition. And poet Fleeta Brown will provide us with a thoughtful commentary. Barbara Disborow has had a very successful professional life as a college teacher and respiratory therapist, but lurking behind that professional facade was a less-than-secret addiction, chocolate. And now that addiction has produced a wonderful new book, The Guide to Chocolate in the Grand Traverse Region. It's sort of a field hunter's guide to all things chocolate. Welcome, Barbara.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Barbara, this book is encyclopedic. Everything about chocolate in this area except where to find the 12-step program.
Chocolophiles don't want or need a 12-step or a 1-step or an 87-step program. We just need chocolate.
This is a great book. It's a beautiful
Thank
book,
you.
Well laid out. It covers the topic. You start with sort of mainlining chocolate, large pieces of it. We move to fudge, chocolate,
stuff.
Milk, baked products. Eventually, we're finishing up with things that are one part per million chocolate, but you cover it all.
Thank you. I tried.
How did you get started on this?
Well, I started on chocolate. It just comes naturally. But when I moved to this area...
How did you get started on the book? Not how did you get started on chocolate.
When I moved to this area about 5 years ago, of course, I have to always ask people, where's the chocolate in town? Or if you got any good chocolate in town? And I just kept rolling my eyes going, someone needs to write a book. And so after a while, you just become someone. And so this last February, probably about last February of 2008, I started doing research, and it just fell together.
So in less than a year.
Less than a year. It's
you
amazing.
You produced this book.
Amazing. Yeah. Including all the tasting. It's amazing.
And all
yeah. It's great.
And it required a lot of field research.
Well, we wanted to be serious about this. When I started the project, I really wanted other people's input. And I actually initially thought I might do a rating book, and then that fell away. That's not as fun as just eating it all, you know. But I thought I was going to have to run an ad in the newspaper looking for tasters. And when I started mentioning it to my friends, they looked at me blankly like, me, choose me to taste your chocolate. And so I came up with a great group of people who taught me about tasting chocolate and were very serious about it, very dedicated. And yes, we did our research.
Okay, and talk about the research. How did you get the chocolate? How did you sample it? What was the process?
Well, in the beginning, we met 2 to 3 times a month, mostly about 2 times a month. And I would go to a chocolate shop, and I would just stroll in and say to people, hi, my name's Barbara Disborow, and I'm writing a chocolate book, and I want to buy an assortment of your chocolates. And I'd ask them about their chocolates, and I'd pick a selection so that we were eating kind of across the product line of a particular provider. So on one night, we would eat one person's chocolate. Generally, that's how we started with all the chocolates, was eating one brand at a time. And we would eat in a certain order so that the palate would be ready for the next flavor, just like you do with wines.
So how did you cleanse the palate between the...
Sparkling water.
Sparkling
and they
water.
Begged for coffee and tea. I said, no. And if they couldn't do the sparkling, they got just plain water. So when we moved into the desserts, they go, please, can we have coffee now? It's like, yeah, you can have coffee with desserts. But we were very pure about it, and we did our sparkling water and cleansing the palate. And
so, do you have a rating sheet, or
the first time we met, I brought just a bunch of neat chocolates. Someone had brought me some chocolates from France, and I had some others, and we just met at a friend's house. And I had come up with a list of ways that I thought we might classify chocolates, and so we just. And we actually started with the questions that are in the back of the book. I had about 20 questions of funny things like, do you think you're a chocoholic? And when did you know that chocolate was important in your life? Or what things are you embarrassed to talk about involving chocolate? So we started with that and shared our answers, just got everybody
that
laughing.
That may be the next book, the
That's
sequel.
Right. That's right. That's right. And so we talked about how we might, what categories or what descriptives we would use about chocolates. And we had everything from the mouthfeel to the snap of the chocolate to the meltability. And while we were fixing or amending our list of things, someone pointed out, well, we need to talk about presentation. I went, oh, I hadn't thought about that. So we added that to it. We wanted to know not only do the chocolates look like, but what does the box look like? How is it wrapped? How was it presented to us when we purchased it? And so when I do tastings with groups, that's one of the things. I show them the boxes first before we get them all out. And then we would eat them in a particular order, and I'd give everyone these sheets, and they would write down their comments. And if they made really funny quotes or quotes that I liked, I'd make sure I got those written down. And then I would go home and basically assimilate all that information, take all of their comments and type it up and think about the pieces we had eaten and gather all those notes. So we did that from February about through September or something, and I wrote some of the introductory pieces earlier, but I actually started writing the book itself late summer when I sat down and said, okay, now I have to do something with these sheaves of information. and I wanted the pieces to sound like they come together, but I didn't want them to sound formulaic. Mm-hmm. I wanted to keep a certain tone about it, but a freshness with each piece that I wrote. But it was actually, the actual book was written in a number over several months, and I'm very pleased with that. It was amazing, and my artist did a stunning job of getting it laid out in that time frame.
Absolutely, and as you say, when I read the book yesterday, every piece is new and fresh.
Oh, good.
So as you go from good. Various establishments, it's very original. Maybe you'd read a few paragraphs from the opening to give us
okay.
a sense of what it sounds like.
I'd like to do that. Okay, this is from the introduction. Sampling chocolate is a worrisome job, so I knew I would need a cadre of dedicated tasters. I thought I would have trouble finding these. Foolish me. I began mentioning my ideas to social and business contacts. In no time, I had my group of chocophiles with, quote, discriminating palates and articulate vocabularies. It was great to have folks from different aspects of my life come together and develop friendships via the common denominator of chocolate. My real surprise was that the members of the tasters group would have a dedication to chocolate equal to mine and that they would take this job very seriously. I'll add a little thought in there that one of the things that the chocolate group have all said to me since we've continued to meet as chocolate eaters but not as tasters is that they think it's a wonderful group of people that have come together through this medium, so because they mm-hmm. all didn't know each other either. There is a chocolate for every palate and for every budget, and we're so blessed to have such high-quality local ingredients, cherries, honey, herbs, dairy, wine, etc. I was moved by the fact that all the producers I met have a vision about the niche their chocolates would fill and about the quality of their products. They each imbue in their chocolates what we hope to enjoy from them.
Thank you. So we start with the serious chocolates.
With pieces, pieces of chocolate.
Like pieces.
Yeah.
I don't know if serious is the right term.
Oh, they're all serious.
Oh, they're all serious. Okay. And then you move to fudge.
And then, well, there's so many fudges, and you really had to talk about fudges separately than talking about truffles and creams and bar, you know, mm-hmm. clusters, those kind of things.
I mean, I learned this whole nomenclature of...
Well, and this is the fudge land, right? You know?
Yeah, and home of the fudgies.
Yes, and there are about 15, that I know of, about 15 kinds of fudge in this region. And I'll say for the book, the region is up from about Leland, sweeps down through Frankfort. We ate our way over through Traverse City and up the corridor and all the way up to Mackinac Island.
The mother load
yes,
of fudge.
Yes, and I had to draw the line somewhere. I mean, I could, you know, there's candy everywhere, but I said, okay, I'm not crossing the bridge. You know, we're not going, although there's a few other areas that are a bit outlying that got included, like the sweet shop from Cadillac and, the chocolate house in Gaylord and a couple
yes.
of other places.
You also talk about baked goods with chocolate.
Right. Then we went into desserts. And I initially thought that we would survey restaurants, but restaurants are fairly inconsistent in their desserts. And so I did include delis, you know, but not any particular restaurants. And then we moved, yeah, so then we went from the fudges into the desserts. And then someone in the chocolate group, bless their heart, all their little hearts said, we haven't done sauces yet. So someone took it upon herself to bring all these sauces. And for this tasting, we had our plates and we had to mark on our plate where it was 12 o'clock. And then we had a dab of fudge. I think we had 7 or 8 sauces that day going around the plate. And we did the same thing. We tasted them with this clarity, this dedication, with this clean spoon, you know. And then at the end, of course, we took our favorite ones and put them over ice cream and ate them all, you know.
Ah.
And then we move into beverages.
Some of them are liquor, some of them are not. Let's start with just there was one that was sort of an espresso, or it was just...
Oh, Liquid coffee. Gold.
Yes.
Liquid Gold at the Espresso Station Bar. Right. That's a they take actual cocoa, not not the cocoa powder you buy, but actually chocolate nibs,
mm-hmm.
and or a powder, and it's combined with milk and sugar, and it's stirred and heated for like 45 minutes. It's 45 minutes. It's paddled and heated so that it just becomes very velvety.
So do I have to wait 45 minutes to get this?
No, you just have to buy it between Thanksgiving and May, I think it is, and she has it there most of the time. No, so she has it going all the time with the little paddle stirring it all the time to keep it creamy. And it's just incredible. I've had it in a number of places outside this region also, and it's just rich and thick and decadent and very chocolatey. It's just, it's wonderful.
I mean, I'm not an extraordinary fan of chocolate, but when I read that part of the book, I was ready to get in the car and drive to town because...
You know, one of my favorite liquid chocolates, which I stumbled on very early here, is Shetler's chocolate milk. I mean, it's amazing chocolate milk. Oh, my gosh, it's amazing chocolate milk.
Everything they make is
Well, it is, and we're blessed to have that milk product, those milk products here.
And then I was sort of surprised to find chocolate beer or porter.
I'm not a beer drinker. I say that up front. And I have thought... Through the years, like maybe 20 or 30 years, I've been having this impression that people who like beer don't like chocolate and people who like chocolate don't like beer.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had this unofficial survey going for about 20 years where I ask people. And to me, my unofficial results are that it's about 80% mutually exclusive, that chocolate drinkers and chocolate eaters and beer drinkers are not generally the same person. So, and remember the days of chocolate cheese? Back in the 80s or what?
My wife liked chocolate cheese.
Well, one of the questions on my initial 20 questions that we did was, what chocolate aberration is just too much for you to even try? And for me, chocolate beer was on the list. And so then people kept asking me, are there chocolate beers? Are there chocolate beers? And so I started asking around. And while we were waiting for chocolate martinis to be served one day, I asked.
That's the next topic, yes. Chocolate martinis.
Oh, God, that's another topic. I said, is there a chocolate beer? And the waiter said, well, we have a chocolate porter. And this, we said, well, we better try it, I guess. You know. And for a non-beer drinker, if I'm going to drink a beer, it's going to be a dark beer and it's going to have a lime in it. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was served room temperature and it was dark. And the chocolate kind of blossomed after the beer was out of your mouth. You
mm-hmm.
know, it was an aftertaste. And we judged it not bad. We're not beer. Neither of us were beer drinkers. And we judged it not bad that we'd try it again sometime.
And then you cleansed your palate with the chocolate martinis.
Then we cleansed our palate with serious chocolate alcohol. And they are so smooth. You don't get the alcohol taste about it at all. They are so rich. They're so smooth. They're beautiful because they drizzle chocolate syrup down the side of the glass first, the dark chocolate. Then it's filled up with a clear or a lighter liquid so you can see this chocolate oozing down and puddling on the bottom, and you have this challenge of getting to it, you know. And they go down way too easy. So if you go to drink chocolate martinis, have some food and take somebody, you know, take
driver.
Cab money. Take some cab money with you.
One of the interesting things about this book and a lot of books that are being produced now is that they are niche books. There is definitely a readership out there, but it's not the kind of thing that one could easily get a publisher to do. And you've done this book yourself. It is as professional as it can be.
It is absolutely
gorgeous.
Thank you.
What's next?
I want to go back and comment about the publisher for a second.
Yes.
I talked to the publishers here in town, and they were extremely helpful. They just gave me tremendous suggestions from printers to layout, whatever. But one of them said, how many chocolates are in this area? And I didn't actually know at that point, but I didn't want to answer the question anyway. And I said, I hedged, and he said, well, there's not enough chocolates to write a book about. You need to do the whole state. And I said, do you eat chocolate? And his answer was, well, no, but my wife does. I thought, there's clearly enough chocolate in this region. And that was another reason I stayed with my own with self-publishing, is that it's a local interest book. I don't have an interest in the rest of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly this book is being so well received. I cannot believe it. I'm blown away every day by the reception the book is receiving. And it's focusing on the culture here in Traverse City. I have a number of irons in the fire or envisions on the horizon, whatever. As a respiratory therapist, I am working on two books in the field of sleep apnea, and one's a children's book for mm-hmm. children using it. Another is a handbook, and then I have some other chocolate and non-chocolate ideas that involve this region, and lots of other chocolate ideas too for the summer and for tourists. And
well, this book is beautifully written. I'm sure it's going to attract a big audience. I know my wife went through it as mm-hmm. soon as it arrived.
It's fun because it has the maps, which is wonderful. It has the coupons, and the stores are starting to tell me that the coupons are coming in now, which is really exciting for them.
Yes, at the back of the book there are discount
coupons. Oh, about 30-some coupons. And my artist, Sue Sudeikum, just did a stunning job. We gave such attention to the detail, from the color of the ink to the color of the paper. I sign all of my books in the official chocolate ink pen.
And the
she did a stunning job on the layout.
The typeface or the ink color mm-hmm. is a nice sort of a milk
chocolate. She could tell you what color. She could tell you the number of that ink, and okay. She did great on finding other graphics and things.
For listeners, where can they get a copy of this?
Well, there's so many places. It's out all over the place. You can get it in the bookstores around the area. That's okay. From, you know, all the small towns on Petoskey, Charlevoix, Traverse City, Cadillac. Many of the chocolate stores have it, and as soon as I have more time, more of the chocolate stores will have it. They can also get it at Oriana. They can order it through the website, and the website is GT, like Grand Traverse, gtchocolatelady.com. Or if you do a web search on Google that says Guide to Chocolate in Traverse City, it'll pop up.
Great. Okay, so the author is Barbara Disborough, and the book is The Guide to Chocolate in the Grand Traverse Region. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
And now a commentary by Fleeta Brown.
We're off for London soon to visit my daughter and her family. Last year when we were there, I was invited to read poems and talk about poetry for three of my grandchildren's classes, 4th, 7th, and 8th grades, at the American School. Students come there from many countries and aesthetic traditions. It's tricky to find poems that work for them. But we all love metaphor, the way it overlaps one thing with another, so that each thing absorbs part of the other's qualities. I read this poem from one of my early books for Noah's 4th grade class. It's called Dock. Say dock, dock. It's just a hollow of itself, the way the foot echoes between wood and water, the plank, plank of it, like piano keys, growing hollower farther out under the stars. Listen to the way docks closed in by the tongue on one side, pushed out at the far end toward the lake with a duck sound, quack sound, where they congregate for crumbs. It's even a tongue itself, saying nothing but what you bump against it, or an arm reaching out. Here you're willing to make yourself sociable, declare yourself separate from the trees. Dock here, you offer. Here is a place to stop. And it's true. Indeed, I have to stop at the end and think. The reason for walking out here is how the end goes blunt. You feel your blood turn back toward the heart, but for an instant you imagine it longs to keep moving out, like Roadrunner at the edge of a cliff, keeping on with nothing built to hold him up. Turning back, I carve a cul-de-sac in the air, which is a comfort and a sadness. In Noah's class, we practiced the word dock to see how it closes off the tongue at the beginning and opens it at the end. The hollow sound under your feet, the sound of the word dock. I had them stick out their tongues, like a dock out into nowhere. They didn't know the word cul-de-sac. They call it a terrace. But they could say at once why reaching the end is both a comfort and a sadness. It's a simple poem that plays with a word, lets it range into its possibilities. Could you write a poem about one word? I asked. They chose the word clock and took off. Language itself, of course, is metaphor. The word piano stands for a four-legged wooden creature with 88 teeth. When a poet makes a metaphor, the dock is a tongue, both objects appear in front of our eyes at once. The mind stretches to connect. The mind learns to accept more than it dreamed, to dream more than it thought it could. What does the poem Doc mean? Who knows entirely? When we play with language, we keep moving out into new worlds. When we reach the end of where words can take us, we stand out there at the edge like fourth graders, amazed.
Thank you, Fleeta. A commentary by Fleeta Brown. You're listening to Michigan Writers Radio on IPR News Radio. On Michigan Writers on the Air, we normally spend our time talking with poets and prose writers. From time to time, we reach out to artists in other areas to chat about their creative process. And today I will be talking with guitarist John Wunsch, a noted composer and musician. John is an instructor at the Interlochen Arts Academy. He has concertized in Europe, Japan, and throughout the United States. And these days, he's a very popular performer in this region. His solo CDs are Timeless Beauty and Looking Towards Leelanau. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much, Aaron. A pleasure.
You know, we usually are investigating how people come up with their ideas to produce stories, novels, poems. But then we try to think about what other people do. What's your process? How do you begin the composing process?
Well, first, I come from a very particular place. There's one particular consistency. I do not allow myself to have inspiration unless I'm in a framework where I know I can use it. I feel that's somehow a violation of my relationship with my muse. If I receive the idea, I have to sit down and use it. So the first step is just opening the door to that. I have to know that I'm going to have time to sit down and take advantage of that either now or within the day. And beyond that, it's pretty much of an open door. Sometimes looking at a certain thing when I'm in a frame of reference to compose, when I'm in a period when I know I'm going to compose.
Let me push back on this a little bit. So the inspiration doesn't suddenly reach you as you are driving down the road, or you put yourself in a place where it's allow it to happen?
I can give analogies, you know, because we're only talking about how we think things work, really.
Exactly.
But it has become pretty much throw the switch. Doesn't mean it's going to be there right now. Boom.
Yep.
But I spend a lot of time with the switch off because of my belief that when I'm given a good idea or inspiration, it doesn't mean that some series of notes wouldn't pop into my head and hear, you know, here or there. But usually, if I haven't thrown that switch, what pops into my head is existing material of mine or someone else's, because mm-hmm. my mind is always wrapped up in music. Mm-hmm. So I have periods when I know I'm in a composing project mode. I have a need, so the switch is open. But there are a lot of periods when I know I'm not going to have time, or that's not what my life focus is right now. And there are the periods in between where if an idea occurred, I've got enough time I could work with it. So, you know, I'm open to that. But yes, that's really what it's become for me over the years. I don't think it was that way when I was younger. And, you know, your process evolves.
Yes. But you're very busy. You're a teacher. You're a performer. So you sort of segment that into
a particular time. Yeah, I do. And I actually have recently not been composing except in the context of using my compositional skills in arranging. So when I do an arrangement, I'm going to certainly take that arrangement, not exclusively, but almost always, and I'm going to move into material that's not really that's like an improvisation. It's a variation mm-hmm. on the theme, or it's a complete departure from the theme, or it's an even departure from the form. So I've been doing that some, but for the most part, frankly, this is a period where I have not been composing because I'm wrapped up in teaching. I'm wrapped up in recuperating my skills through some health issues that took away my playing a number of times in the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. But I am now back on a phase where I do believe I'll be getting into some composing here in the next 6 months.
Okay, and in your composition, you know, writers, we often work in a writer's group, or we have friends who we take our work to, and we get feedback, and then our revision comes from feedback. Do you have something similar to that, or is it when you actually go out and play your music, when you perform it,
well,
that it goes through a revision, or is it a done deal when it's done?
Well, it's both. And more over the years, I've been fortunate to have that done deal when it's done experience. But in the early years, never.
Mm-hmm.
Always a revision. And in the very early years, with a teacher who would give me the feedback, and then later with my fellow musicians when I was working in ensemble settings more, primarily my touring band in the 80s. And then as I got into more solo composing, less and less of that. Now my revision process is self-inflicted, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
I tape what I'm doing, I listen to it and see how it works. Whether it's later in the performance process where I'm revising the presentation, I may even then change an idea, pull something out, and realize I need to recompose it. But mostly it's in the composing process, get something down. I can hear it in my head, and that more and more over the years is how it works. But in the end, I'm going to tape it. I'm going to listen to it.
Mm-hmm. And then we go towards actually playing it for an audience.
Mm-hmm.
But it's done by then.
Yes, if for the yes, I'd say to them almost exclusively. There are very few things anymore that I revise past the point that I've performed them. Rarely. It's more the revision as a presentation. It now you're the performer, just as I'm performing someone else's music, I'm going to tape myself and be very critical of how I present it in terms of the phrasing and all the features of communication.
Okay, and once it's done, how important is it to you then that there is an audience fairly quickly?
That question is at least there are two distinct tracks that relate to that question. On the one hand, my basic belief in two responsibilities we have in life, why I'm here at least. One is to internally myself be in a space that's healthy and that contributes to the consciousness in a positive fashion.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think I'm here to be a positive influence directly on other people. So in terms of that, it's very important. I want people to hear it because I believe it has a quality that will influence their lives positively. But it is critical to my own, you want to call it mental health or spiritual
yes.
health,
yes.
that I am composing and playing my music. So I would play it and compose it anyway for the sake of that. That's my contribution also to the world and to the universe, is keeping myself healthy and sane. But if I can, I'm not completed with it until it's in front of an audience. So I use my performances as often as I can on my regular appearances, which throughout my life, when I was in New York, I had a regular house appearance place when I wasn't concertizing. And I've done the same thing here, primarily with the Bowers Harbor Inn. When I'm not concertizing, I put it out there every week that I can for people to enjoy it.
Great. Do you want to talk about one of those compositions?
Well, yes. The difficulty is there's so many, or it's a pleasure for me, so many different things I like to play. But I like in particular most, for years, my main influence was the more Spanish styles. That's mm-hmm. what made me play guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So I consistently keep that in my repertoire. So I think a good representation that combines my own composing with the style that my guitar playing came from is the tango. And mm-hmm. I have a tango called the Tango Dorissimo, which was inspired by the love of dancing that my good friend Carter Strong and his wife Doris Strong have. And she's Spanish and has kind of brought that into his life. And so it's the Dorissimo, like pianissimo, very mm-hmm. Doris tango.
Great. We'll hear that now.
Good. Thank you.
Is the music we've just heard representative of your music or your approach to making the bigger picture?
It's representative, you know, in terms of, I hope, what the quality is.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be hard for me to pick one piece to be totally representative. I've become a specialist in not specializing or not limiting myself. When I play a concert set, it will have... a classical work of the Spanish nature. So this is representative of that, but it will have one that I have not composed.
Mm-hmm.
It will have a number of my own compositions. This is representative of that. It will include something on the 12 string, which this was on. But usually I'm playing most pieces. The vast majority now are back on the classical guitar.
Mm-hmm.
For a number of years, I carried three guitars, my steel string acoustic, my classical, and my 12 string. Just out of efficiency, I cut that back. But it's not representative of the fact that I include a jazz standard. I include something with a blues influence, a tune like Fever, for example, or some of Thelonious Monk's tunes.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not representative of the more melodic, spacious, peaceful pieces that have been a staple. So it's only representative of those two sides, my own compositions and the Spanish influence and the 12 string, not representative of the classical, of the other styles, and of the other energy, the calmer pieces.
Now, John, you grew up in this area.
For the most part.
And then you wandered away for a long time, studying, yes. Playing.
Yes. Yeah, for that reason.
If I would go through your complete curriculum vitae, we would have about... an hour of my reading, who you studied with, and
I've been
and who you played with.
Yeah, very fortunate.
And now you're back, and a lot of your compositions seem to be influenced by this area as well.
Extensively. And now the interesting thing that takes me to is that even when I lived in New York, I didn't compose in the city. I might revise in the city. Now, in the very first early years, there were a few things I wrote there, but I didn't even keep those. Those aren't in the repertoire. I just consider those developmental. A few years into being there, I realized that the only times I finished works that I wanted to use were when I left the city, either on tour or for a break. And many of those times I was coming here.
Mm-hmm.
So throughout my life, I've needed to be in a pastoral setting outside of the intensity of the city to compose. Even when I'm composing something that's funk or salsa or blues, it's not that they all had to be pastoral pieces. Now, since I've lived here, a lot of my inspiration has come from the region, and I just love the beauty and the feeling. And when I left, however many years ago that was, in the early 70s, I always knew I wanted to be back here eventually. I didn't leave going, this town just hasn't got what I need. I left saying, I need to explore more first.
Yeah. And you've, in fact, produced two CDs that give money to the Land Conservancy.
That is true. I have my Timeless Beauty CD. Profits from that, a portion of that, have gone to the Grand Traverse Conservancy, and with the Leland Law CD, that's the case with the Leland Law Conservancy.
And so environmental issues are really an important issue to you as well as music.
Right? They are, to the degree that I've actually actively engaged in some important projects, and since the time I was in high school, I've been involved with various environmental action groups.
So let's talk about you and music. How does music define you as a person?
Very extensively, at least in two ways. One is, as I said, it creates, I think, my balance, my spiritual and psychological, emotional health, which influences my physical health. And the other is, since it was as a young man trying to struggle with whether to be a musician, having assumed I was going to work as a politician for causes, I was getting the inkling that the music was really taking control, didn't know what to do. And a friend a little older than I was working on the family farm with me said he was an active artist. He'd made his decision. And he said, here's how it works, John. If you can't not do it, you belong in the arts, and otherwise you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't not do it. And I really was a number of years before I was about 27 and I was in New York and I'd already finished music school and been playing actively for a few years. And suddenly it just, like, ding, one day I remember sitting in the cab on the way to a job going, this is it. This is how I make my living.
I'm cool. A musician.
I'm a musician. So from that point forward, it defines me because that is my main pursuit. So my activity is with it. So decisions such as how do I now contribute to society are influenced by that. I now contribute to society, I hope, by working well with my students at Interlochen. I'm so fortunate to teach there, mm-hmm. have these great kids come to me in this excellent environment, great support system. And two, I work myself to take time to go and play in hospitals and nursing homes. And I have a significant part of my program is that my students have a number of performances every fall and mm-hmm. every spring where we go and play at Munson Hospital and at a variety of nursing homes, hospitals, assisted living, retirement centers, and sometimes underserved schools.
It's interesting with the arts because I think in most other professions, you're a doctor or a teacher or a lawyer or whatever. But as an artist, it takes a long time to say, I'm a guitarist, I'm a musician, I'm a poet, I'm a prose writer. There's something very different about that. You improvise as you compose. And that is very hard for me to think about as a writer.
Well,
I may do it, but I don't know how to think about it.
Sure. I think they're two different things, or they're two different ends of one spectrum, and they intersect to varying degrees in different circumstances. On the one hand, at one end of the spectrum, composing when it's in its most... Well, sometimes developmental form, but other times in a form which is going to be clearly set, and by a type of composer who works this way, it is truly a process of thinking through and setting down and making decisions. Well, on the other end, you have improvisation, which externally at least appears to be free development of thought as you go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, really in my world, and I think for all musicians, those two things are the same process at a different speed. On the composing end, it's a very slow, deliberate process, or can be. And mm-hmm. on the improvising end, it's a very instantaneous and effervescent, natural process at its best. But there are all kinds of experiences before you improvise of learning and developing different approaches that can be used in improvisation, much like the language. I didn't use these words for the first time today, but yeah, I'm communicating something different. And on the other end of the spectrum as a composer, at least in my experience, as time goes on, I find that the decisions have less and less conscious weighing and thinking. They're more gut-oriented. They just are clear, to the point that I've been so fortunate in more recent years to have stream of consciousness composing be my process, where the notes start to come into my head at a pace that I can assimilate them, write them down, look at them, and I find in several cases I don't change a thing.
Wow.
And that's just a beautiful thing. And that's where the thing. That's where the two kind of come together.
So a composition that shows that would be...
Well, I think Quiet Times is one of the best examples of not that process where it came through and every note was exactly where it was, but a process before that or to one side or the other of that where I did have an initial idea, but it came to me while playing, and that idea I used in sort of a undefined filler feature in different performance situations, only as long as it needed to be to use the idea, but not expecting it to be a complete work. Then over the period of, I don't know, 6 months or a year, I realized I had almost a complete composition. And then I did sit down and say, okay, I know what I need. I need something in this key, and I need more of an arc to the line. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm going to sit down and finish it with the middle section. So that's a piece where the opening section is stream of consciousness, improvisation on the gig, so to speak. And the middle section is that composing where I sit down and let the energy come through. And I did make some craftsman decisions on that, which is the other feature of the composing, the slower process. You can stop and look at it and say, okay, well, does this really work?
Okay, let's listen to Quiet Times.
Excellent. Thank you.
John, this has really been terrific. Thank you so much. Where can people find your CDs?
My CDs are in stock at Borders.
Okay. And the titles?
And Timeless Beauty.
Okay.
Is both the title cut and the title of one of the CDs. And Looking Toward Leelanau, which Quiet Times came from, is the other CD.
And you're performing locally on a regular basis.
I am.
Gigging, I guess, is the right word.
Yeah, now that I've really reached recovery from these amazing three times in the last 4 years where I literally couldn't play, I'm taking advantage of it. I'm at the Bowers Harbor Inn every Friday and every Saturday this winter and spring. And I can quite honestly say that the food there under our chef, Paul Olson, is tremendous. So I feel that someone can come out and not only enjoy the music and the beautiful location in that old building, but have a great meal. So I hope some folks will join us.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for joining us this month for Michigan Writers on the Air. I want to thank our guests, Barbara Disborough and John Runch. Also, my thanks to Fleeta Brown, Interlochen Public Radio, and Michigan Writers, Inc. Check out the Michigan Writers website at www.mishwriters.org for an updated list of workshops and activities. My gratitude to our production crew here at IPR, Peter, Jack, Brock, and Brad, and to the Neptune Quartet for our lively theme music. Be sure to listen next month to Michigan Writers on IPR News Radio 91.5. The show airs the fourth Saturday of the month at 7 p.m., repeating on Sunday at 1 p.m. Until then, we wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.